where she had expected him to be, right beneath the spy hole, at the iron door that blocked his escape from the labyrinth. He was standing there, one hand on his hip, the other holding out at an angle the wooden staff, as tall as he was, to the tip of which clung the soft will-o'-the-wisp. His head, which she looked down upon from some 6 feet above, was cocked a bit to the side. His clothes were those of any winter traveler or pilgrim, a short heavy cloak, a leather tunic, leggings of wool, laced sandals. There was a light pack on his back, a water bottle slung from it, a knife sheathed at his hip. He stood there, still as a statue, easy and thoughtful. Slowly, he raised his staff from the ground and held the bright tip of it out towards the door, which Arha could not see from her spy-hole. The light changed, growing smaller and brighter, an intense brilliance. He spoke aloud. The language he spoke was strange to Arha, but stranger to her than the words was the voice, deep and resonant. The light on the staff brightened, flickered, dimmed. For a moment it died quite away, and she could not see him. The pale violet marsh light reappeared, steady, and she saw him turn away from the door. His spell of opening had failed. The powers that held the lock fast on that door were stronger than any magic he possessed. He looked about him as if thinking, now what? The tunnel or corridor in which he stood was about 5 feet wide. Its roof was from 12 to 15 feet above the rough rock floor. The walls here were of dressed stone, laid without mortar but very carefully and closely, so that one could scarcely slip a knife tip into the joints. They leaned inward increasingly as they rose, forming a vault. There was nothing else. He started forward. One stride took him out of Arha's range of vision. The light died away. She was about to replace the cloth and the tile when again the soft shaft of light rose up out of the floor before her. He had come back to the door. Perhaps he had realized that if he once left it and entered the maze, he was not very likely to find it again. He spoke, one word only, in a low voice. "Amen," he said, and then again louder, "Amen." And the iron door rattled in its jams, and low echoes rolled down the vaulted tunnel like thunder, and it seemed to Arha that the floor beneath her shook. But the door stayed fast. He laughed then, a short laugh, that of a man who thinks, what a fool I've made of myself. He looked around the walls once more, and as he glanced upward, Arha saw the smile lingering on his dark face. Then he sat down, unslung his pack, got out a piece of dry bread and munched on it. He unstopped his leather bottle of water and shook it. It looked light in his hand, as if nearly empty. He replaced the stopper without drinking. He put the pack behind him for a pillow, pulled his cloak around him, and lay down. His staff was in his right hand. As he lay back, the little wisp or ball of light floated upward from the staff and hung dimly behind his head, a few feet off the ground. His left hand was on his breast, holding something that hung from a heavy chain around his neck. He lay there quite comfortable, legs crossed at the ankle. His gaze wandered across the spy hole and away. He sighed and closed his eyes. The light grew slowly dimmer. He slept. The clenched hand on his breast relaxed and slipped aside, and the watcher above saw then what talisman he wore on the chain, a bit of rough metal, crescent-shaped, it seemed. The faint glimmer of his sorcery died away. He lay in silence and the dark. Arha replaced the cloth and reset the tile in its place, rose cautiously, and slipped away to her room. There she lay, long awake in the wind-loud darkness, seeing always before her the crystal radiance that had shimmered in the house of death, the soft, unburning fire, the stones of the tunnel wall, the quiet face of the man asleep.